From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
If we really want to improve health in America, the first thing we would do is tell people not to diet.
That's Paul Campos, the author of The Obesity Myth, Why America's Obsession with Weight is Hazardous to Your Health. He'll join us later in the program as we focus our attention on obesity.
I kind of like the rise that it got out of people, too, I have to admit, because if I say I'm fat, people, like, jump. And I'm like, I'm not evil. I'm just fat. Like, it's I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to eat you. You know, you're safe. You're fine.
Wendy Shanker, who says that if we can't take it off, then we might as well just take it on. But first, the documentary that supposedly caused McDonald's to discontinue its supersize portions. It's a film of epic portions called Supersize Me. Morgan Spurlock directed the film and won the Best Director Award at this year's Sundance Film Festival for Supersize Me. We'll meet Spurlock in just a moment. First, here's a clip from Supersize Me.
America has now become the fattest nation in the world. Congratulations. Nearly 100 million Americans are today either overweight or obese. That's more than 60% of all U.S. adults. Since 1980, the total number of overweight and obese Americans has doubled, with twice as many overweight children and three times as many overweight adolescents. The fattest state in America? Mississippi, where one in four people are obese. I grew up in West Virginia, currently the second fattest state in America. When I was growing up, my mother cooked dinner every single day. Almost all my memories of her are in the kitchen. And we never ate out, only on those few rare special occasions. Today, families do it all the time, and they're paying for it, not only with their wallets, but with their waistlines. Obesity is now second only to smoking as a major cause of preventable death in America, with over 300,000 deaths per year associated with related illnesses.
It's a clip from Morgan Spurlock's documentary Supersize Me. It's a film in which Spurlock eats three meals a day at McDonald's for 1 month. He has to eat everything on the menu at least once, and he can only supersize his order if they ask him if he'd like to. Spurlock was in good health when he started his McDonald's diet. It didn't last.
Very early on, you know, I started to get these weird kind of pressure on my chest, you know, this weird pressure. I started to, you know, get very depressed, you know, about 10 days in, you know, incredible bits of depression that would be alleviated by eating. Like, I would eat the food and feel great, be very elated, and then get depressed again. I started to get massive headaches that would also only be alleviated by eating, you know, something that's very, very similar to, like, an addictive reaction. By about the halfway point through the diet, I could not perform in the bedroom anymore. That disappeared. And then by the third weekend, my blood tests were off the charts. By the beginning of the third week, my cholesterol had gone up about 60 points. My liver was so filled with fat that the doctors were comparing it to pate. And by the end of the third week, I was waking up in the middle of the night, and I woke up in the middle of the night and had massive chest pains. I couldn't breathe. You know, I felt like I was having heart palpitations. And at this point, all three doctors were like, you got to stop.
Now, there's no question in your mind or theirs that this was all related to diet? I mean,
no,
there's nothing else going on in your life?
Nothing else. No, there was no other question that it was caused by
diet. What about exercise and keeping yourself fit? Because you're a guy who was in, as you say, very good shape at
sure.
the beginning.
But I mean, I'm sure I could stop exercising and, you know, and go eat plenty of other things and not be waking up in the middle of the night with chest pains.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you exercise during the course of the diet?
I walked about twice as much as the average American does. You know, most Americans get no form of exercise whatsoever. I think it's about 60% of Americans get no exercise. And so during this month, I was emulating that. And so the average American walks about a mile and a half. So I was limiting myself to about 2.5 to 3 miles a day.
Your girlfriend is a vegan.
She is. The irony just gets better.
Yeah, and we should talk about that.
Yeah.
But if she's a vegan, then presumably much of the diet that you ate prior to beginning the McDonald's diet
Usually we would eat, if we ate dinner together, it would be vegetarian or vegan.
Okay.
Yeah, but during the day, it's like that's when I would get all the stuff that I want to eat. You know, because I am a big fan of the fine swine. You know, I love bacon. I can't get enough of the bacon.
How did your vegan, healthy girlfriend take to the idea that you were going to do this?
She was appalled from the beginning. You know, she was the voice of reason from the get-go. She was the one who said, nothing good is going to come of this. She said, nothing good is going to happen to you doing this. She says, this is such a bad idea, I can't even tell you.
She does appear throughout the film, as a matter of fact. And in the middle, I guess you were saying you were having trouble with your physical relationship. And
correct.
She was pretty clear that was diet related.
I mean, it was incredible how that just came out of nowhere. Now, I was just kind of exuding this McMusk too, you know, like I just kind of had this fantastic deep fried aroma to myself all the time.
Wow.
I think they should market that. I think we're onto something.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to McDonald's about this?
Or? You know, they would never. They would never speak to me directly. You know, since the film's come out, you know, they've been chasing me around. You know, following me up on interviews. You know, sending their spokespeople out to kind of refute the film, but they've never sat down or said anything to me directly. You know, they call the film a gimmick. They say it's just a vehicle to make a movie, that it doesn't serve any purpose, you know, that I'm a little late to the dialogue when it comes to this issue. And you know what? I think I'm showing up right on time when it comes to, you know, this dialogue, because I think this film has ignited more discussion and more dialogue and more change in such a short period of time than all the news stories you could imagine.
Do you think there's been change in the fast food industry because of it?
Well, I mean, you got to think. McDonald's, 6 weeks after the film premiered at Sundance, McDonald's announced they were eliminating their supersize options. They said by the end of this year, there'll be no more supersizing. And then they said it has nothing to do with that film whatsoever. So, you know, I think everyone else here in the real world, you know, knows better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think from doing all of this was the most surprising thing you learned?
I mean, for me, the most horrifying thing in the whole movie, apart from what happened to me health-wise, because, you know, that's self-inflicted. That's something I'm doing to myself. So, it's, you know, that's not a shock to me. But for me, the most surprising thing and the most disturbing thing in the whole movie is the state of school lunches in America and what we're feeding our kids and the path we're putting them on from a young age that is leading them to being unhealthy and being overweight or obese. You know, you walk into a school lunch program, and it's like the kids are having lunch in the middle of a 7-Eleven. You know, they got pizza and chips and candy and ice cream and soda and ding-dongs and ho-hos, and that's lunch. And it's terrible. And this is what we're teaching our kids. It's okay to eat this. And at the same time, we're eliminating physical education from schools. You know, so we're telling our kids, you don't need to, you know, to exercise. Phys ed isn't important. You know, and we're getting rid of nutrition and health education classes. So we're saying, you know, you don't need to learn about what you eat or why you eat things or how much you should eat, because that's not important. And so now in this institution of learning where we're preparing the kids for the future and we're, quote unquote, educating them in the classroom, we're abandoning them in the lunchroom.
What do the school systems say when you say that sort of thing to them?
They say, well, that's untrue. You know, we provide a balanced diet for the kids. We feel it's important for the children to learn to make the right choices. And I find that to be so frightening because for me, you know what, this isn't the place where these kids need to have those choices. Because if you give a kid a choice besides a candy bar or some broccoli, what's he going to eat? What's a kid going to eat? You know, a slice of pizza or some asparagus?
You know, there is a woman who's on the talk show circuit now, also making a movie, who, after viewing your film, I guess, decided that she could go to McDonald's and actually lose weight and has done so.
Sure. And she's lost weight. She came into this being clinically obese. Now she weighs like 168 pounds, I think. It's great. I think she was 178 pounds and 5'3" when she started the diet, and now she's lost weight. I mean, the thing is, she's doing the two things that no Americans ever do. You know, she's going into a fast food restaurant and she's eating less, and she's exercising. Wouldn't it be great if everyone in America ate less and exercised? But that's not the world we live in. We live in a world where we overeat and we under-exercise and we don't think about what we're shoving into our mouths. And the film is really about the bad choices we make every day. And we need to change that. We need to become more aware. We need to get more information to make more educated choices. And it is a two-way street. I mean, you know, people love to say, well, it's not the corporation's responsibility. You know, I disagree. I think if you feed 46 million people a day like McDonald's does, 46 million a day, you have an obligation to help educate your consumers to make smart choices.
Morgan Spurlock, director of the documentary Supersize Me. And this is the song of the same name from the movie.
Right now you have the urge to eat something. When it's through, if you still want to eat, then you're probably really hungry. Think about what I'm saying.
F-A-T, that is me, but I didn't used to be. I was hot, I was hungry, I was loose, I was free. Then I waited in the line for some burgers and some fries. Supersized, that'd be nice, take a bite and close your eyes. Round two, what do? I can barely walk around. Jenny Craig, Richard Simmons, but I still love to pound. Hamburgers, Coca-Cola, getting gas from too much soda. Double-double, chunky-chunky, hope this meal is never over. The world is round, and so am I. Big boys, big girls with real big thighs. Supersize, supersize the American way. Throw it down all day, every day. Supersize, supersize the American way. Getting fat, getting broke, either way you're gonna pay. Supersize me. Supersize me.
Morgan Spurlock's documentary has received a lot of critical acclaim. it's also received a lot of criticism. From Soso Whaley, for one. She's the woman that Spurlock and I talked about a few minutes ago. Whaley tried the same McDonald's for a month diet as Spurlock, but unlike Spurlock, Whaley actually lost weight, 10 pounds, and she lowered her cholesterol. She was more careful about how much she ate, and she also exercised. Whaley's turning her experience into a documentary. What's her beef with Spurlock's film?
Well, I guess what really bothered me was the fact that people were taking this so seriously that somehow or other he had proved some great scientific experiment. I mean, all he did was go in and eat a lot of food, and he gained weight, and he made his health bad. I mean, people, we already kind of know that, you know. It's unfortunate that we kind of don't put that into practice, that understanding, and, you know, feed ourselves properly.
Of course, he did do exactly what he said he'd do. He was going to go to McDonald's and eat three meals a day there and eat everything on the menu at least once. And if they asked him if he wanted to supersize it, he was going to supersize it and eat it. And there was no fooling around. But you thought he's simply made a bad choice?
Well, it was bad choices. I could have gone to a vegan restaurant myself and gained 10 pounds, 20 pounds. I could have done the same thing anywhere. My grandmother's kitchen, you know, the local tavern down the street, the five-star restaurant in New York City. I could have gone anywhere and done the same thing, and so could he. Basically, all he did was just eat. From what we can tell, we don't know exactly what he was eating. He has never released that information, but about 3,000 to 5,000 calories a day. And, I mean, really, people don't necessarily do that. We do have some problems, some weight problems, but... You know, I think that was really out of line.
You know, Morgan Spurlock says his film isn't really meant to be an attack on McDonald's, but an attack on our lifestyle, on, in fact, the same things that you're upset about, the fact that people eat so much fast food.
Yeah, so to speak. But, you know, the thing is that Morgan's film really kind of comes down on the side of being able to do obesity lawsuits. I mean, basically what he's claiming is that, ooh, look, I ate a lot of food at McDonald's and I got really sick, you know. And he claims that there's long-term health effects. You know, I saw an interview where he said, oh, well, this is what could happen down the road 20, 30, 40 years, you know. Well, you know, I hate to burst his bubble on that, but I was born in 1955, and actually so was McDonald's, ironically enough, you know. I've eaten there a very good large part of my life. You know, has been spent driving through the drive-through window or going to McDonald's to eat food. I mean, not every day, of course, but a lot. And, you know, if I was going to have long-term health effects from it, I think I'd certainly be showing those by now.
Some people have said you're just trying to ride the publicity wave of Morgan Spurlock's film.
You know, no, actually, I'm just so angry at the level that we've gotten to at this point. This is supposed to be a documentary, you know. A documentary, if you look up what the real definition of a documentary is a work of nonfiction. And it really bothers me, just as a film buff in general, that there are some documentaries, and, you know, Morgan Spurlock is included, and, you know, we got to go to Michael Moore as well, where facts and things are manipulated to create a certain picture. And in my mind, that really isn't a documentary. But to be recognized as such by, you know, Sundance and even the Oscar, you know, it just kind of bothers me. And I'm sure it does a lot of other filmmakers as well.
Filmmaker Soso Whaley, she's producing a documentary about her McDonald's diet, in which she lost weight and lowered her cholesterol. Whaley says her documentary is not being funded by McDonald's. If you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website, conveniently located at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the obesity myth as we continue to focus on the issue of obesity.
The weight loss industry is essentially selling a cure that causes the disease which the cure is supposedly addressing. You know, if P.T. Barnum were alive today, he'd basically say there's a dieter born every minute.
Also, we'll meet the author of The Fat Girl's Guide to Life.
It's like, if this doesn't work, you know, that's it. We're going to have to call Richard Simmons with the cherry picker to pull me out of my house when I'm 700 pounds.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Paul Campos is the author of The Obesity Myth, Why America's Obsession with Weight is Hazardous to Your Health. According to Campos, the barrage of reports and studies which claim that fat kills are misleading. He told Steve Paulson that it's all part of a very complex cultural phenomenon.
Once you see how warped the arguments are and how poorly supported they are by the medical literature, which is just extremely ambiguous and complex on this issue, then you have to come up with some explanation for how we got into this really confused and, I think, culturally mixed up situation on this. And the reasons are essentially social and political and economic and have nothing to do with science per se, and everything to do with, I think, three factors which are crucial. One, there's a $50 billion a year weight loss industry in the United States, and it's extremely beneficial to that weight loss industry to exaggerate the health risks associated with higher than average weight to the greatest extent possible, because all of their treatments have side effects, many of them dire. And in order to get such treatments tolerated by the government, it's necessary to have some sort of argument that these side effects are a necessary evil while we pursue this holy grail of weight loss. So that's one factor. But I don't want to overemphasize that factor. It's not as if people are sitting around conspiring on how to exaggerate health risks for the purposes of making money. I do believe there's some of that going on, but for the most part, the people who make this argument are sincere. They're, I think, very neurotic and misguided, but they are sincere in their beliefs. But they, like everybody else, are affected by strong economic motivations. And one of the strange things we have in this culture is this kind of weird belief that doctors and scientists, for the most part, are not subject to the same economic motivations and pressures as everybody else. I think that there's really no basis for believing that. And clearly, part of what's going on here is that there's a lot of money to be made by fomenting fat hysteria, although, of course, the people who are doing that are usually not thinking of it in those terms, either consciously or even necessarily unconsciously.
So that's one factor.
One factor. A second factor, and I think this is really quite critical, is that we live in the United States in a profoundly eating disordered culture. It's simply normal in the United States right now to have a disordered attitude towards food and weight and dieting and body image and weight loss and all of these issues. And one thing that I discovered in speaking to people who were deeply involved in this issue is that very often it was pretty obvious that they themselves had, shall we say, unresolved issues in regard to this whole topic, which they were projecting onto the medical data. So when you would present people with data which seems to contradict their views, they would simply say black is white. So you'd look at a study and the study doesn't really support the argument that weight loss is something that's desirable or that higher than average weight is necessarily a significant health risk, but it simply has to be tortured into that form because I think a lot of these people are working under what is known in the eating disorders literature as anorexic ideation.
Wait, are you saying that people who are advocating weight loss, who are often participating in these studies, have eating disorders themselves?
Well, I want to be careful about this because I want to be clear what I'm saying here. I'm not saying that most obesity researchers are actively eating disordered. After all, it's quite difficult to get diagnosed as having an active eating disorder because we tend to have very, very high, we set the bar, you know, at a very high point before you can be diagnosed as having an eating disorder. Despite the fact that we do that, we still have 8 million people in the United States who are currently diagnosed with eating disorders. Nevertheless, there is an enormous amount of eating disordered ideation. That is what is known as thinking in the same way that a person who is diagnosed as having an active eating disorder thinks among the people who are advocating weight loss as something that is desirable. I do not think that it's a coincidence that when you go to a conference at which all sorts of extreme claims are being made about the obesity epidemic, that a lot of the people who are making these claims are upper-class, high-achieving, perfectionist white women who are both very thin and seem to have a lot of control needs and a sort of pathological fear and loathing of fat. That happens to be the exact social description of people who are at the highest risk for anorexia nervosa and bulimia, and I don't think that that's coincidental. Now, on the other side of this, and here's something which I really do believe ought to be emphasized more, is that when you look at the people who are making these claims, many of them are people who have a body mass index higher than they say is desirable and who at the same time also live healthy lifestyles. So many of the obesity researchers who are claiming that, A, there is a, you know, great risk associated with having a BMI of higher than 22 or 25, and B, that if you have a healthy lifestyle, you will have a BMI below 22 or 25, don't themselves, even though they do have quite apparently healthy lifestyles. And so they themselves quite literally embody a contradiction of their own views. So that's a second factor, this kind of eating disordered culture that we live in, and how we have these neurotic attitudes towards weight and how that distorts our thinking on these subjects. The third factor is, I think, a generalized anxiety in American culture right now about overconsumption. I think especially among the elites and the upper classes, there's a lot of anxiety about overconsumption in America, and with good reason. I mean, after all, there is an enormous amount of overconsumption that goes on in the United States, and the higher you are in the class hierarchy, the more likely you are to overconsume. So the irony here is that the one form of overconsumption which appears to be inversely related to class status rather than directly related is caloric consumption. And so basically what you have is a bunch of skinny rich people on one level obsessing about fat poor people and talking about, oh, isn't it terrible that these people are overconsuming so much, even though the skinny rich people are living in 5,000-square-foot houses and driving the equivalent of Abrams tanks with a leather upholstery on the inside and engaging in all sorts of egregious overconsumption of a much more socially significant kind than eating, you know, Krispy Kreme donuts or what have you. And yet they focus on this essentially trivial form of social overconsumption, partially as a way of displacing their anxiety about the overconsumption that's taking place in the culture as a whole in much more significant ways than anything that relates to weight.
So you're saying that a lot of these causes for sort of the, I guess what you would call the hysteria about obesity are social in nature rather than medical. And yet, I've always heard that if you weigh too much, you are at greater risk of heart disease and even cancer.
Well, if you actually look at the data on this, it's quite striking. At the very same time that we've had a significant increase in the average body mass of the United States population, we have had an absolutely astonishing decrease in the mortality rate from heart disease and hypertension. So, for example, we would be having 1.1 million more deaths per year from just those two conditions in the United States right now than we actually have if mortality rates from those diseases were the same as they were 30 years ago. Now, that's, of course, not an argument to claim that somehow an increasing body mass of the population is protecting us from overweight and, from heart disease and hypertension, but rather it indicates what a weak correlation there actually is between having a BMI of more than 25 and heart disease and hypertension. There is a correlation, but it's weak. And furthermore, and here I think something quite striking, if you look at people who weight cycle, who lose weight and then regain it again, there is a striking correlation between that kind of weight cycling and congestive heart failure and hypertension. So it may well be that most or all of the excess risk that is somehow blamed on being heavier than average, having to do with, for instance, heart disease and hypertension, is actually a product of the dieting that heavier-than-average people engage in at a much higher rate than people who are thin. So that's part of, you know, the explanation for, I think.
So you're saying the real risk, then, is people who do the yo-yo dieting, who feel like they're too heavy, they go on some diet plan, they do lose weight, but then, I don't know, a half a year later, they put it back on, and then a couple years later, they go through the same thing again. That's the real medical risk.
Yeah, that's the real medical risk, and ironically, that ends up making people heavier than they would be otherwise. There's no question that if you look at people of similar initial weights, the ones who diet in a regular way end up weighing more than the people who never diet. And so what we have here in the United States is the weight loss industry is essentially selling a cure that causes the disease which the cure is supposedly addressing. You know, if P.T. Barnum were alive today, he'd basically say there's a dieter born every minute. It's an immensely profitable kind of pattern, but it's one that's very, very detrimental to people's health. If we really want to improve health in America, the first thing we would do is tell people not to diet.
Not to diet at all.
Absolutely. If there's
eat whatever you want.
By dieting, I mean the following. I mean intentionally restricting your caloric intake and increasing your activity levels for the purposes of reducing your weight. I would say to people, absolutely pay attention to good nutritional practices. If you have an eating disorder, if you engage in binge eating, then that's certainly something that needs to be addressed. And you know, there are some people who weigh more than they otherwise would because they have unhealthy habits such as binge eating and or sedentary lifestyle. But here, I think the key is to focus on those habits. That is to focus on the binge eating, to focus on the sedentary lifestyle, and to find ways to encourage people not to engage in those behaviors rather than focusing on their weight. Because after all, there are a large number of people in America who are thinner than they would be if they had healthy habits as well. And it's far from clear which is the larger medical problem.
So what should we do about what you call the obesity myth?
Well, the first thing we need to do is to recognize it for what it is. And then once we've done that, to the extent that we do that, then I think we ought to focus on what's actually important to health, which is to encourage people of all shapes and sizes to be physically active, to eat a balanced diet of nutritious food, not to engage in eating disordered behavior, including dieting, not to obsess on weight, not to try to conform their bodies to this ridiculous and arbitrary ideal, but rather to have a healthy attitude towards these issues. And, you know, I think that we can't begin to do that until we recognize that many, many people, millions, tens of millions in the United States, will be overweight and obese even if they live perfectly healthy lives. The notion that somehow everyone is going to have a body mass index of below 25 if they have a healthy lifestyle is absolutely as bizarre as the claim that everybody will be more than 6 feet tall if they have a healthy lifestyle. There's absolutely no basis for believing that's true. And it's just a sign of the ideological distortion that surrounds this issue that such a frankly crazy idea could ever be made an implicit part of American public health policy, and sometimes even an explicit part, because sometimes people will actually come right out and claim this. They'll say, there would be no fat people. And remember, I'm a fat person, according to these descriptions, and George W. Bush is a fat person, and Brad Pitt is a fat person. There would be no fat people like George W. Bush and Brad Pitt and Paul Campos if we all had a healthy attitude towards, if we all had a healthy lifestyle. And that's just wacky. I think if we recognize how wacky that is and instead engage in healthy habits for their own sake rather than for the sake of producing extreme thinness, which, of course, it will not produce in most people, then I think we would be healthier, we would be happier. And here's the final irony. I think we would actually also be a little bit thinner as a culture.
Paul Campos, he's the author of The Obesity Myth, Why America's Obsession with Weight is Hazardous to Your Health. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Supersize.
Stop eating.
We're part of the solution.
Supersize.
We're part of the problem.
Supersize.
Supersize.
We're part of the solution.
Supersize.
We're part of the problem.
Supersize.
We're part of the solution.
The question that Wendy Shanker keeps coming back to over and over is, why do other people care if she's fat? After all, Shanker doesn't have a problem with using the word fat to describe herself. The title of her book's a dead giveaway, The Fat Girl's Guide to Life. Wendy Shanker talked to N. Strange Champs about the F word.
I really like the word fat, and I think part of the problem with the word fat is that it's gotten associated as an emotional word or a word that describes somebody's personality or attitude. And my feeling about the word is it describes my size, like it describes my body. It's sort of the opposite of the word thin. There's fat, there's thin, there's whatever is in between. And the euphemisms really bugged me.
Like why? The euphemisms like overweight or heavy or
voluptuous,
you don't like those?
And curvaceous. I mean, you know, you can be thin and curvaceous. You can be fat and not be curvaceous. It just seemed like fake words. Like people were getting away from the subject of the matter. And I'm not afraid of being fat and I like it and I'm healthy and fat. I'm fit and fat. And I kind of like the rise that it got out of people, too, I have to admit, because it doesn't matter. If I say I'm fat, people, like, jump. And I'm like, I'm not evil. I'm just fat. Like, I'm not going to do anything to you. I'm not going to eat you. You know, you're safe. You're fine. And I think it's really surprising for people to see me and they say, but you're not fat. And I say, oh, hon, I'm 225.7. I'm fat any way you want to measure it, but I'm not a bad human being. I'm not lazy. I'm not unambitious. I'm everything you are. I just wear bigger pants than you do. So taking the word out of the fear out of the word fat and the drama out of the word fat and just using it as a way to describe physical stature makes it a lot less threatening and a lot less insulting when people say it.
Well, your book tells the story partly of what it took for you to get to the place where you could say,
yes,
hey, I'm fat and be comfortable,
yeah,
with it. So tell me about this sort of body odyssey that you went through.
Well, I started dieting when I was a teenager. Once I hit puberty, my body started changing, and I was just mystified that, you know, all my skinny friends were eating ice cream and chocolate chip cookies for lunch, and so was I, but they were staying skinny, and I was definitely blown up. So I tried every diet in the book, you know, starting with Weight Watchers and, you know, Jenny Craig and Dexatrim and Quick Weight Loss Center and, you know, you name it, I tried it. And my whole life I thought, you know, I have a great destiny ahead of me. I just need to be thin in order to achieve that destiny. And I finally sort of hit rock bottom in terms of thinking about my weight and my life, and I had lost a job, and I had just really sort of hit a hard place in my life. So I went to the Duke Diet and Fitness Center, which is it's sort of like the Betty Ford Clinic for fat people. You know, like, you're like, that's it. When I've tried everything else, I'm going to Duke. And I went down there for a month.
Like, if they can't fix you, nobody can?
Exactly. It's like, if this doesn't work, you know, that's it. We're going to have to call Richard Simmons with the cherry picker to pull me out of my house when I'm 700 pounds. And so I went down there for a month, which is the standard sort of procedure, and supervised by doctors and nutritionists and fitness trainers and everything, and had a perfect supervised month of weight loss, everything, perfect to the nose. And at the end of the month, I had only lost 2 pounds. It was so expensive, it added up to, I think it was $4,715 a pound is how the money played out. And I was standing on the scale, looking at the scale, thinking about the money, thinking about the stress and the drama, and I went, that's it. I'm done with this. I'm going to be fat. I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to be smart. I'm going to live my life, but I cannot live by the numbers on the scale. There's got to be a better way to do this.
This flies in the face of so many cultural assumptions we make. I mean, for one thing, one large one is this idea that people who are fat for a reason, that they're not exercising enough or they're eating too much. I mean, don't you think we sort of have this assumption that nobody really has to be fat unless they're doing something wrong?
Sure. And people will read my book and they still say to me, could you just eat a little less? Or could you just, what if you just, you know, went to the gym more? And it's like, how many more hours am I supposed to spend at the gym? Everybody's body is different. And you and I can do the same physical regimen. You and I can eat the same foods. You and I can, you know, have the same attitudes and belief systems, and our bodies will just respond in a completely different way. And I think, you know, the first thing that people say is, but it's not healthy. It's not healthy. And to tell you the truth, there's so much research right now that points to the fact that you can be fat and fit, that really a sedentary life as opposed to actual physical weight on your body is really a bigger problem. I think it's people less worried about my health and more worried about just this assumption that you just can't be fat. It means you're just like this loser, like you're just this lame, horrible person. And if you really cared, if you really loved your children, you'd lose weight. If you really loved yourself, you'd lose weight. And I've done it, been there, done that. It ain't happening. I'm going to be fat. And that's no, you know, and you worry about yourself, you know, but excuse me, I will keep the bread basket on the table. It doesn't mean I'm going to eat the whole thing. I'll have a piece of bread. But, you know, it's really telling people, you know what, you don't need to worry about my body. You can mind your own body, and I'll mind mine. And thanks very much for playing. And I'm just glad I can find cute clothes to wear and live my life and be a happy person.
When you got to that point at Duke when you just said, that's it, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm never going on another diet, and I'm going to try to learn to like the body that I have.
Yes.
What changed in your life then?
Well, ironically, it was like a weight lifted from my shoulders. you know, the biggest thing was a sense of liberation. I mean, a real, almost tangible sense of, I've been telling myself, feeding myself a certain line for so long, and to just let go of it and to let go of the pressure from other people sort of pushing that same line with me just leaves a lot of room in my head to accomplish a lot of other more important things, whether it's, you know, focus on my job or focus on my health or focus on relationships and friends and family and goals. It's just, it leaves me a lot more space and energy to not have that constant thing, that little message running in my head of, you're fat and ugly, you're fat and ugly, you're fat and ugly, you're a bad person, you don't care, you're evil, you're lazy, you're bad. It's just, you get a lot more space to dedicate to yourself in a much more positive way.
Can you hold on to that? Because what happens when, you know, you start to think, I'm okay like this. This is just, I'm going to be okay and I'm not going to think about it. I've got better things to think about. What happens the next time somebody says, hey, you know, I heard of this new diet. Maybe it would work for you.
Oh, they still say it to me. But what's interesting is if somebody said something like that to me, like, I'm only telling you this because I love you. Thank you for sharing. As if, you know, but if you want to lose weight, I read this book and blah, blah, blah. Now, first of all, there's the assumption that, what, I didn't know I was fat. Like, I didn't notice when I washed my body in the shower this morning how it looked or how it felt or, you know, I know Fat people know they're fat, by the way. And every fat person I know is trying to change it or do something about it. Everybody knows they're fat. So we don't need the information from other people, FYI. What I started to do is, instead of taking on that information, because when somebody says that to me, it's not about me. When you start a sentence with, I'm only telling you this because I love you, that's about you. That's about you worried that Wendy's not going to get married because she's fat. Wendy's not going to get a job because she's fat. That's your concerns. I'm not worried about those things. So instead of taking on that negative energy or feeling badly about myself, I say, you know what? If you want to go on a diet, you go for it. I'm doing great. Thanks very much. And I push it away. And it's shocking because nobody ever thinks the fat girl is going to talk back to them. You know, I told the story that I was in an elevator in my building and I'm going down in the elevator and the woman behind me in the elevator mutters under her breath, you know, I take the stairs to stay slim. And I couldn't believe the gall. Now, a couple years ago, I would have turned red in shame. And, you know, I never would have been seen on that elevator in my building ever again. But I turned around to this woman and said, well, too bad you didn't take it this time. You know, and she backed away. I mean, we're in an elevator, and P.S., I'm twice the size she is. I'm not about to, like, roll over like a boulder on somebody, but I'm an imposing figure to this little old lady in the elevator. But you know she's probably been making cracks about fat people her whole life, and nobody's ever talked back to her. So she shrinks back in the elevator, and she looked horrified. But I wasn't about to take on her drama. If she wants to take the stairs, take the frickin' stairs, lady. You know, more power to you. I never want to see you again.
What else changed in your life besides sort of freeing up more mental and emotional energy, more space when you stopped worrying about your weight?
I'm definitely a lot more flirtatious. I definitely dress differently. I'm definitely a lot more forthright in work situations. I took a job soon after where I was working at MTV, and it's a big boys club over there. And the girls working on the TV shows were just shocked at me. They're like, hey, how come when we go in for our morning conference meeting, you sit down at the table with all the boys? I'm like, girls, come on. Sit down at the table. Like, this is, you know, I wasn't worried about being evaluated on the way I looked or the way I dressed. You know, again, my focus was on my personality, my accomplishments. So that is sort of very liberating. And that, you know, it's actually, I start my book by talking about the F word fat and end it talking about the F word feminism. But it's made me a stronger woman, a stronger feminist, and I think a stronger force in general, because I'm much less likely to say, like, well, maybe that guy's going to make fun of me, or he's not going to take me seriously because I'm not some little skinny, chippy with my, you know, thing hanging out of my belly shirt. Like, I just don't, I let it go. I assume I'm, if he wants to assume I'm hot and sexy, great. If he wants to assume I'm all business, great. You know, my relationships with men, I think, are a lot stronger and a lot more professional and exciting. And you know, like, if I go into, there's always the assumption, like, you can't be a fat girl and go into a bar and pick somebody up. And I've dropped that. I can pick up whoever I want to pick up, which is really fun. And I dress better. I definitely dress better also. I won't wear, like, big, floppy, you know, hide my body, moo-moo stuff. I try, like, there's great companies like Torrid.com that make really sexy clothes. And I like to wear things that fit me and show off my favorite features. And so those are all really positive steps for me.
Wendy Shanker is the author of The Fat Girl's Guide to Life. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Coming up, the world's heaviest athlete, sumo wrestler Manny Yarborough. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, to the uninitiated, sumo wrestling hardly looks like a sport. It seems more like two huge fat guys grappling with each other, trying to get hold of these diaper things they wear to throw their opponent to the floor. Well, the world of sumo is a whole lot more complicated. And one of the greatest ambassadors of sumo wrestling is the American, Manny Yarborough, himself a former amateur world champion. Steve Paulson recently talked with Manny Yarborough. Steve, what was the occasion for the interview?
He's one of the sumo wrestlers featured in the documentary film Sumo East and West, and he came to the Wisconsin Film Festival to talk about the film and about the world of sumo wrestling.
I understand Manny Yarborough is actually quite an athlete.
Yeah, actually, he was a big athlete in college. He played college football. He was an All-American wrestler. He placed high in judo competitions all before he became a sumo wrestler. And in fact, he says that he could even dunk a basketball when he weighed 500 pounds, and he now weighs a lot more than that.
And in fact, Yarborough's earned the title, hasn't he, in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's heaviest athlete?
Yeah.
What was it like to interview a guy that big?
Well, he's an enormous man and a very likable guy. And I have to say, I've never quite done an interview like this before. I'd originally talked about having him come over to the studio, but he would only fit in a van. And so that was just too hard. So I went over to his hotel room and went up, and he was sprawled in a love seat, totally filling up the couch. And I moved in as close as I could to him. I stretched my arm out as far as I could. And only that way could I actually get the microphone near his mouth. And he says that whenever he travels, and he travels by plane, it can be an ordeal, because when he came to Madison, he almost got wedged into his seat and couldn't get out. But he does say that size is not everything when it comes to sumo wrestling.
It's not really the size of the man in the fight. It's the size of the fight in the man. And if you see some of the matches, especially on the amateur level, there's plenty of times where you've seen a 200-pound guy beat a 500-pound guy due to sheer determination and will.
How big are you?
Right now, I'm 6'7", 740, but it's all muscle.
And when you won the amateur world championship in 1995, what was your fighting weight then?
About 680. I was starting to escalate in the weight department right then. I started out at 525. So I did, over the 12 years, I've actually gained over 200 pounds. Not to say that I encourage people to do it. It's not in my best interest, and eventually I'm going to have to make an effort to try to get it off. So
how did you get so big? How did you get up to 700 pounds?
You know, I wish I could sit here and say that it was through the, you know, ancient Chinese secret of doing this and that. It's just a culmination of different factors. I hate to say it, when I first started sumo, I had a job where I was delivering medical supplies. So I used to run up and down steps all day long. And then my job relocated, and I didn't relocate with the job. So I actually became more sedentary because I wasn't moving as much when I left the job. So that's really what happened. If you're used to being somewhat active, and when you slow down and you still probably eat the same, then you're taking in more than you put out. And this is the end result of it. This is just my natural progression in life, not following through with as much exercise and probably just eating everything in sight.
What do you eat in a typical day?
It varies. I don't have a set regimen. There's days where I try to follow like a 2,500 calorie diet. There's days I follow an 8,000 calorie diet. I mean, it's just whatever I run across. Like today, all I had was two bags of peanuts all day long. Now tomorrow, who knows? I might go cow tipping and bring the cow home tomorrow. It's just whatever I run across.
What's the appeal of sumo wrestling for you? I mean, you've done a lot of sports. You've done wrestling, football, judo. Why sumo?
When I went to Japan, because I was like the normal person. I was against it. I was like, oh, it's unappealing. You got these fat guys bumping bellies. You got the guys eating sushi. I could never imagine myself eating raw fish or whatever. I was closed mind until I actually went over to Japan, and the guy showed me the ropes as far as how these guys live and how they train. These guys are modern-day warriors. They're like modern-day samurais. They live where they train. When you're a sumo wrestler in Japan, you're a sumo wrestler 24 hours a day. It's not like here you're a baseball player, then you become a regular person. You have to uphold being a sumo everywhere you go. You have to walk a certain way. You have to present yourself a certain way. And I just found that appealing. And then I've also liked one-on-one sports. I mean, I like football and basketball, but I like the sports where you have to hold your own as an individual.
Now, the other thing about sumo is there's so much tradition in this sport. I mean, I know legend has it that it goes back thousands of years to when two
two Japanese gods were wrestling each other. But, I mean, that ritual is so much a part of, certainly of sumo in Japan.
When you fight over there, and this is probably the only sport where it has like a ritualistic or religious ritualistic aspect attached to it, that, like you said, it goes back at least 2,000 years. And these guys, they take it serious. Like when they toss the salt into the ring, that's to purify the ring, to hopefully that no one gets hurt. And then when the guys, they do the clap and they show that they go with their hands out like that, that's to show the guys that they're fighting with no weapons. And there's something kind of rugged and something samurai about that that doesn't exist in other sports. And they want all the countries, and all the countries follow the tradition. So it's good to see that ritualistic aspect of it. Like, you know, you got guys using cell phones after touchdowns and stuff like that. See, none of that doesn't exist in sumo. And it's good just to see that guys can fight the best they can and then have camaraderie afterwards and try to uphold the rules of the sport.
Well, and the other thing that I've noticed is when I've watched sumo matches in Japan, there's, if you didn't see the match, you wouldn't know who won, because they bow to the opponents, bow to each other. There's this, basically, no one has any expressions. There's no joy if you've just thrown the other guy. That's just all part of the way you're supposed to do it in Japan.
That's the first thing that you're taught. You're not supposed to know whether a wrestler has won or lost. You're supposed to remain even keel no matter what happened. And if you saw the movie, I know you saw there was a part where Wayne, because Wayne used to be a former professional, and he won this tournament, and he went crazy. And I can understand, because Wayne has always, he's been a subdued person all his life. And for all the things that he went through to come back to win that tournament, he knew better not to do it, but I think it was beautiful that he did do it, to see this guy express himself like that. But he knew down, you know, if he was in Japan, he wouldn't be able to do that. So it was just kind of, to me, that was the most telling point of the movie, because knowing what he went through and knowing what was involved to him to get to that point, it was... It makes me cry every time I see that part of the movie. So that's the best part. And yeah, that's something that they learned from day one.
Now, in the movie, Wayne was an up-and-coming sumo wrestler, an American, a Hawaiian, who went to Japan. And then he got hurt. And then he had surgery. And that was, what, the end of his professional career?
Yeah, see, you know, it's not like American sports. Those guys, if you get hurt over there, it's not like you... You have access to the best doctors or whatever. They put you the best you can and let the chips fall where they may. So in his case, that he got hurt, and when it was time for him to return, he just couldn't do it. I don't think he got the best medical attention at the time neither. You know, they have a ritual when you first get to Japan. It's called Matawari, where the guys stretch you out. The first thing they do is they put you on the ground. They put a 400-pound guy on your back, and they push you down to the ground to rip up all your ligaments. And they don't send you to the hospital. They give you a day to recover, and you have to go back out there and wrestle. So, like I said, these guys are old-time samurais, man. That's the way of the warrior that these guys live.
Well, I have to say that the part of the film where they're showing the training, and especially for guys who are just starting, what do they call it? I mean, they call it punishment. And it's just, I mean, for one thing, these people are like, you know, sitting down and basically doing the splits. And then what? You have some guy who will just come and sometimes just jump on top of you, on your back.
Yeah, that's how they become flexible. I mean, these guys are amazingly flexible. We did a demonstration in Switzerland with the Japanese team, and they bought some dancers, and the Japanese wrestlers were just as flexible as the ballet dancers. These guys, that's their training regimen, and that's every Japanese sumo wrestler goes through that. You know, that's something that they have to go through, but that allows them to become better wrestlers. And
Wait, you're saying that a 400-pound or a 300-pound sumo wrestler is as flexible, as limber, as a dancer?
Yeah, and I know it sounds unbelievable. One of the most amazing things is when they do the stretching demonstrations, when they stretch their legs out, they can actually put their stomachs on the ground forward. They put their stomachs equal, they go straight forward. And they always encourage people, you know, take pictures of this. This is something that you don't see every day. That's just a training regimen that they follow. And, you know, these guys, they get beat. You know, there's no sporting event that you find coaches that can beat you legally. These guys, they get beat with sticks, and you have to perform. It's all a matter of a performance. And if the Oyakata doesn't like the way you're fighting, he'll keep you out there for an hour.
Now, I'm guessing, given the physical demands, can be, I don't know if dangerous is quite the right word, but people, a lot of people must have health problems.
You know, what's strange, like the Japanese guys, they put the weight on, but when they retire, the weight flies off of them. I don't know what they do. It's like they were never heavy. You know, people from this side of the world, it's not as easy. You know, someone like myself or even Hawaiian guys who have the propensity for carrying the size, it becomes a little bit more difficult. So yeah, there's going to be some health issues, but, you know, they've done studies, and there are doctors who will tell you that the fat that a sumo wrestler has is good fat, if there's such a word, because there's a good fat and there's a bad fat. But from the training that these guys do, they develop, the fat that they develop is actually considered good fat. I've been told by a couple doctors that being a fat guy, at least I got the good fat as opposed to the bad fat.
The world's heaviest athlete, sumo wrestler Manny Yarborough. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And here's former sumo wrestler Kunishiki with a song called Living Like Kings.
Make way for the sumo, coming straight outside more. Know to shake the ground when the first touch down. Push more weight than cue. Have a girl sipping down on the island in the loop. Built to last like an energizer bunny. Push you 700 and still making money. Step into the door, you're bound to get crowned. Out the line or smash to the ground. Competition, I'm the biggest. I ain't no rookie. Overweight lover and still know the rookie. Bring the house down when I hit the floor and sing karaoke for an encore. So females step on up.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 613A, Fat or Fiction. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert, with engineering help from Marv Nunn, Stephen Colon, and Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Consider a future world in which a vaccine makes you continually happy or a chip in your brain lets you communicate telepathically with your spouse. Sound far-fetched? Well, it may be a matter of when, not if. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll speculate on the post-human future. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.